Welcome back to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, where we bridge learning gaps and empower families to access the special education services they need. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and I'm thrilled to kick off season 3 with you. Our podcast is your go-to resource for special education, offering expert insights, inspiring stories, and actionable tips to help your child thrive. In this season, we'll dive deeper into the world of special education. So whether you're a parent, educator, or passionate advocate, join us in this journey. To make this season unforgettable, please like, listen, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Your support helps us reach more families and create a stronger, more inclusive future. So hit that subscribe button, join our community, and let's make season 3 a game changer. Thanks to listeners like you. Welcome, 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 Rebecca. I'm excited to talk today about differentiation, accommodation, and modification. So welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Can you go ahead and just share a little bit about your background in this space with our listeners so that they can get ready to dive in with us?
Sure. I have been in the special education field for over a decade. I've taught every grade except fifth grade and never got to work with fifth graders, but I've worked in self-contained classrooms for the 18 to 21-year-old transition. I've also been a kindergarten resource teacher, so I've had experience that has run the gamut. And I realized that my real passion beyond helping students was helping the general education teachers who had these kids in their class all day, every day, and needed a little bit more support and understanding of best practices for students with IEPs.
Yeah, absolutely. So my undergrad is in regular ed, and I actually never taught a day of regular ed in my life. It's always been special education. But as you said that, it sparked this thought in my head that during my regular ed training, there was very little conversation about supporting students with learning needs and differences or special education students in a whole. And I know that was a long time ago, and I think the training has gotten better, but to have somebody like you guide a regular education teacher is such a gift. So incredible.
I really enjoy what I get to do. And yeah, you hit the nail on the head. There's not enough training for general education teachers regarding students with IEPs. You know, typically in a collegiate program, you might take one or two classes about special education. It's typically those low incidence disabilities. And then, you know, you graduate, you get your own classroom, and suddenly you have 8 students with IEPs in your classroom, and you're being handed these, you know, 15-page legal documents and told you have to provide all of the services within them. And oh my goodness, it can be so overwhelming. And I know these teachers want to do the best they can for these students, but there's just a lack of information out there. So that's where I try to come in a little bit.
Yeah, and hopefully this podcast will help share some light on the topic and supporting educators and also supporting parents so that they know what they can ask for. So before we kind of jump in, I always like to ask my guest right off the bat a fun fact about them that doesn't necessarily relate to their career. So do you have a fun fact that maybe people don't know about you that doesn't necessarily align with what you're doing right now?
I do have a fun fact, and it is that when I went to college for my undergrad degree at University of North Alabama, I actually had a very small opera theater scholarship. Very small, but music is something that I love. I sing at church, I sing in the car, I sing at home. I have ADHD, so there is always a song in my head that I am singing out loud. But that's my fun fact that a lot of people don't know or they're surprised to hear.
Sweet. I should have asked you to prepare something.
Oh,
belt it out time. Like going next rogue. Going rogue on the podcast. Oh my goodness. Well, that is really cool. That's awesome. So let's set the stage, right? So we're talking about differentiation, accommodation, and modification. Can you help us clarify the difference between those terms?
Absolutely. So when I'm describing them to teachers, I kind of refer to it as a continuum, where differentiation is kind of the the foundation. That's the platform that our instruction is going to build off of. So the next step would be accommodations, which is a little more intensive. It can be a little more specific for individual students. And then the top of that would be modification. And modification is something that is typically reserved for high need situations, whereas differentiation can be universal. Accommodations starts getting a little more individualistic. Modifications, I try to keep those as limited as possible. And there's a few reasons for that.
So tell me, let's start with differentiation. What could that look like? And does a student need to have qualified for a 504 IEP to receive that?
Absolutely not. And that is a terrific question that I think a lot of people misunderstand. They think, oh, well, the student has to be receiving special education services, or they have to be receiving, you know, services through a 504 plan. Differentiation really should be occurring way prior to even the eligibility process for special education, or before a 504 is even considered. That's, you know, that's your foundational instructional practice, is making sure that every student is able to learn the material in the way that makes the most sense for them. And it's not just the instruction. It can be differentiation in the learning environment. It can be differentiation in the assessments and products that the students are producing after the instruction. There's so many different ways to differentiate what is happening in the classroom so that each student is able to produce work and share their knowledge about subject matter that goes far beyond just, you know, a pencil paper test.
So what would that look like? Could you give us an example at like elementary, middle, and high school, the difference of what differentiation could look like? And you mentioned assessments. Would that be state assessments or classroom assessments?
That would mostly be classroom assessments. State assessments, you know, they're very particular about the way things are done. And I have very strong feelings about state assessments. And that could be a whole other podcast episode. I won't get into all of that. Just know that I'm not a fan. But so differentiating classroom assignments, if you have a student who is struggling to produce written work, and the assessment requires them to produce written work, what are you really assessing? Are you assessing their knowledge of the subject matter, or are you assessing their ability to write? So you can differentiate the way you take data for that by allowing the student to maybe respond orally, to dictate an answer to someone, to draw a picture, make a comic book. There's so many other options that can be utilized for a student to show what they know, rather than read this question and circle A, B, C, or D, or write a paragraph about World War I. Like, let the student's interests and what they're good at guide what you're expecting of them. Number one, you're going to have a lot more student engagement. They're going to buy in way more than if you're making them do something that they're not as comfortable with. But also, it can show that the student understands more than possibly what they're being questioned on. I heard a teacher, I think it was a Facebook post from years ago, the teacher always asked at the end of a test, what else do you know that was not asked on here? And I love that, because there are so many, like, maybe a student doesn't test well, but then they get a question like that and they can wax poetic about, you know, any topic that they're studying, because the pressure is off and they're able to show what they know in a way they're more comfortable with.
And then how could that differentiation align with supporting social growth?
To support a student's social growth, you know, if a student has some anxiety around testing, you know, we're differentiating that to make it so that they're a little more comfortable with the methodology being used. You know, you can also differentiate, like I mentioned, the environment. So if you have an area of the classroom that you can make into like a calm down corner, a sensory corner, where they're able to go and calm their mind a little bit, take a break from the hustle and bustle of everyday class, go over to a corner and just work on their self-regulation, having that safe space, and make sure that it's taught so that students know what it's for. They know how to use it, because it's a tool. You know, a sensory corner is a tool, just like a notebook is a tool for learning. They have to know how to utilize it. Also, being able to see themselves in the classroom. So if we're talking about, again, differentiating the environment, we want to make sure that all of our students are represented in the classroom. I shouldn't go into a classroom and only see books about people who look like me. I shouldn't, you know, go in and see posters on the wall featuring only people who look like me. It needs to be a window into other cultures, but also a mirror, so that students who maybe aren't as used to seeing themselves represented have that space, and they know, I'm safe here, I'm welcome here. That setting up the environment in that way can make a student comfortable enough to learn.
And it sounds like differentiation at its core is really best practice, right? So you're utilizing best practice as an educator to benefit. You may have a couple students in mind. However, it's going to really benefit more than a couple students, and really helping to create a learning environment for our students to thrive and grow. And as you so put it, to feel welcomed and feel safe. Is that right?
Absolutely. And yeah, differentiating is best practice for everyone. You might, like you mentioned, you might have one student in particular that you're thinking about. But so I have a book coming out at the end of the summer, Blueprint for Inclusion. And in research for that, I was looking at like the history of ADA, and I came across the concept for a curb cut. And that's when, you know, you're on the sidewalk and you get to a crosswalk, the curb is cut down for easier access for people who use wheelchairs, so they can get off the curb without it being that step down. But a curb cut is not just for people who use wheelchairs. It's also for parents who are pushing their child in a stroller who, you know, are able to benefit from that. It's for the people who are walking, but maybe they have a harder time stepping up onto a curb. They can use the curb cut. So it's something that's designed for one person, but it's beneficial to everyone. And when we start thinking in that mindset about our classrooms, that's when we're going to notice all of the students are able to make the progress that we're seeking.
That's awesome. I've never heard that analogy, but I really like it. Curb cut.
I thought it was great. I thought it was I like visuals and examples and analogies. So when I read that, I know that's something that's going to stick with me. So hopefully other people can think of it now as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So if we think about differentiation as that curb cut, so to say, something that's going to really help support the greater in our community, in our classroom, let's go now to accommodations. What does that look like? And then are there requirements for parents to know to have to ask for accommodations? Let's get in the weeds on that one.
So accommodations, depending on what they are, can be provided to just about any student. You know, if I see a student is working on a math worksheet and they're having a hard time keeping track of counting numbers in their minds, I might give them some blocks to count. Technically, that would be an accommodation, but that's not something that has to be written into an IEP. That's something that I'm looking at the student. This is something that they need to be successful. I'm going to provide it for them. So often, again, accommodations, they think, oh, the student doesn't have an IEP. That's fine. They can still have some accommodations. Accommodations really just level the playing field. They make education accessible. Accommodations aren't making things easier. They're not reducing the complexity of a standard. They're not changing the standard at all. They're making it so that the student has what they need in order to access that information, that curriculum, that classroom. Accommodations can be, again, academic. You can accommodate an environment. Some services can be accommodations. You know, if you've got a kiddo who requires certain things through maybe occupational therapy, physical therapy, those accommodations can be built in as well.
This reminds me, there's a cartoon that is like a teacher at a desk. And then I don't know if you've seen this or not, but then there's like a fish in a fishbowl, a monkey, a dog. I don't know. There's like four animals, an elephant. And basically the teacher is like, in order to pass this test, you need to go climb that tree. And so, right. So the thought behind that is really embracing what we're talking about today and leveling that playing field so that all of those cute little animals have access and preparation to pass that assessment.
Absolutely. I have seen that cartoon and it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, it can seem kind of silly, but when you think about it, often that's what's being asked of students in our classrooms. And whether that's because we don't necessarily know any better, or that's what we're being told we have to do, like if it's a specific test or like a state assessment, that's very discouraging to our students to know this is not something that I'm really capable of doing on my own. But that's why we have differentiation, so that they can show their strengths in the way that's best for them. It's why we provide accommodations to level that educational playing field. And it's honestly, it's just best practice. I know we keep coming back to that, but it genuinely is.
So what would be some more examples of what accommodations could look like?
So accommodations can really range from very, very small, low tech, all the way up to something higher technology. When I taught middle school, my students, that was, you know, the year that we were coming back from virtual learning, thanks to our, you know, the global pandemic that we went through. We were coming back from virtual learning. Students were still utilizing Chromebooks at the time. And prior to that, when I would have students who were not able to read material for themselves, we would have to have someone read it for them. But with the technology, we were able to provide that accommodation through the accessibility features that are already built into the Chromebooks, like the text to speech, where they could go onto a website, highlight it, and it would read it to them. And that's something that was available on all of the Chromebooks. That was something that any student could use. And I personally love an audiobook. I would rather listen to someone else read, you know, a book and be able to really pay attention to what's being said. It removed a barrier for a lot of students. And again, that wasn't just for students who had that in their IEPs, but it could be for any student who might just want to listen to the passage instead of reading it for themselves. Other accommodations can be, you know, to make access a little bit easier. I've seen pencil grips. You know, if you have a hard time holding a pencil, something as simple as a pencil grip can be an accommodation. And when I've had teachers kind of question what the accommodations do, I talk about people that wear eyeglasses. So your eyeglasses are an accommodation that you use to see far away or close up. If I had a student in the classroom who could not see the board, they could get glasses and be able to see the board. I wouldn't just sit there and say, oh, well, you can't see it. You don't get glasses because not everybody else has glasses. Like it's something that's specific to that child's needs. You can look at it as what do they need in order to access the classroom, access the curriculum, access the material in the same way as a typical peer.
Can you explain how you were saying accessing the curriculum? In no way does differentiation and accommodation change the curriculum so that the students are still meeting the requirements outlined by their district or their state in accordance with
their graduation requirements.
So, yeah, so it's not, we're not changing any of the requirements of the standards. We might be changing the way it looks to meet that standard. You know, we mentioned with differentiation, being able to differentiate the types of assessments that are collected, you know, for a student. And with an accommodation, I might use a sentence stem as a like for short answer, like the student might be able to use a sentence stem just to help them start their sentence, get their brain on the right track, and they're still providing that answer. They're still relaying that information. We're not saying, oh, if you, everyone else is working on a multiplication test, but here you can just count these boxes. That's significantly changing the standard. But if everyone is working on a multiplication test and you're using a graphic organizer to help you remember your math facts, or even sometimes a multiplication chart, that's an accommodation because the information is still being taught. The requirements are still the same. We're just making it easier to access.
So then that leads us to modification. So let's talk about that and then how that looks in a classroom and then also how that impacts the state standards.
Absolutely. So I'll use that same example. You got a whole classroom doing multiplication tests and you got one student counting a box. That's modification. You have modified the curriculum. You're changing the standards. You're changing what's expected for the student to be able to know and produce. One way that I kind of explain the difference between accommodations and modifications when I'm doing my professional development sessions or speaking, we talk about a piece of steak. Like, I'm a meat eater. I enjoy a nice medium rare ribeye. Not everyone does. So if we're talking about that piece of steak, some people want it cooked a little bit longer. Some people want it cooked a little bit shorter. That could be your differentiation. Okay. Then moving on to accommodations. If you have that piece of steak, you can grill it as is, get it all cooked nice and neat, serve it up. Or you could cut it into smaller pieces, you know, do like a little stir fry deal, or grind it up and it becomes hamburger meat. Regardless of what you've done, you are still getting that same steak. Everyone is getting steak, just the way they're getting it is different based on their needs. However, for modification is if you have everyone in the restaurant is getting steak and one person is getting chicken, that's a modification because chicken is not steak. And when I've said that before, I look around the room when I'm speaking and it's like, you can just see the light bulbs go off. It's like, oh, because so many people will use accommodation and modification, like swap it back and forth, like, but they're not the same. And a lot of times, especially if a student is older and, you know, you're getting into those, you know, credits required for graduation, if they've been on a modified curriculum, they're not getting all of those required standards. So you have to be very careful when you are providing accommodations versus modifications.
And at what point does an IEP or 504 come into play when we're talking about accommodations and modifications? Because accommodations, yes, as an educator, you can provide some, but at some point, the collective should say, hey, let's maybe make this more formal. So at what point do you see that coming into play? And then what about modifications?
So for the accommodations, if you have something that you've been utilizing with a student regularly, and that student is on an IEP or has an IEP, that is probably something that should be in the IEP so that next school year when they go to their new teacher or if they change schools and go somewhere else, you want to make sure that that is in there so they know, okay, this has been working. This is what the student needs to access the material. Let's make sure that it's still being provided. And that can be, you know, if you've got your data collection and that proves, hey, this is something that's been working, and you have that data that supports that, then absolutely try to get that into the IEP. And then vice versa. If you have data that shows a student no longer needs a certain accommodation, share that and make sure that that gets taken out. Because if they don't need it. We don't want to be over accommodating. We want to give them what they need without giving them too much of what they don't. And then for modifications, that is something personally, I have only ever written modifications into an IEP for one student. And I do want to clarify. So in my state, in Alabama, students in self-contained classrooms are not on a modified curriculum. They're on an alternate curriculum. So it's not that the general education curriculum is being modified for them. They are on an alternative. Alabama even has a separate state assessment for them, the Alabama Alternative Assessment. So they're still receiving their curriculum, not modified. So when I'm talking about a modified curriculum, I'm talking about a student in general education who received services with an IEP. This student in particular was quite young and had not been in school prior to kindergarten. He was not in any sort of Head Start program, no preschool. He came from his home straight to kindergarten. And there were a lot of behavioral issues that impeded his learning. So we made the choice after two semesters, I think it was. We had lots and lots of data to support this. The family was very much involved and very much on board. We elected to modify the curriculum, modify the expectations for the student so that he was able to focus mostly on learning appropriate classroom behavior. We didn't want to be trying to teach sight words to a student who had not had experience with letters yet. We wanted to make sure that the student was able to participate in a way that made sense for him so that he could learn how the environment of school worked. And we elected after 9 weeks, we would go back and reevaluate his behavior to see how much it had improved and then consider removing the modifications to the curriculum. The only reason I did that was because he was so young. We knew we would be able to catch him back up. When it becomes a problem is when, or a concern, not necessarily a problem, but when it becomes a concern is when you have a student at the secondary level who is earning those graduation credits, those class credits. If the curriculum is modified, those credits might not be received. They might not earn those credits because they're not fulfilling the curriculum standards and requirements, which can then play a factor in, is the student going to get to graduate on time? So I'm always very hesitant about adding modifications to a student's IEP.
And also knowing for parents that this would be a conversation that a team would have and the parent would need to be included so that they could then have knowledge of what this looks like for their particular student and then to be able to make informed decisions, right? So
absolutely.
That the parent knows what's going on and what that would look like.
For sure. Yeah. Parent involvement is crucial in every step of the special education realm, especially in deciding placements or deciding accommodations versus modifications, or, you know, what are the goals going to look like? I say that's something that I did. I was the case manager. I wrote the IEP, but it was not a decision that I made alone. It wasn't something that I said, hey, I think we should try this. It was, this is the data that we have. These are some potential solutions. Let's discuss as a team. So as a team, we felt that was the most appropriate for him in that situation. Now that's not going forward saying, oh, well, now we have a precedent set so we can do this whenever. No, each child is different. Each IEP is different. There is no such thing as a precedent when it comes to writing an IEP for a student.
I love that you say that, and I love that you talk about data. I talk about it a lot and the importance of it, but it really does drive your decisions, right? So you talk about needs driving placement, needs driving decisions. So having that data that's concrete, and I always tell parents, you know, ask for that raw data sheet so you can really see the decisions that are being made, why they're being made, that it's not just, oh, well, you know, this student had it last time, so we're going to make it happen this time for you. I think it's incredibly important that parents recognize that they have this power at the sense that they're always at the IEP table. They're going to be the consistent member of that team year to year, whether they change schools or change educators or case managers or service providers, or all those team members can come and go in different capacities. But you as the parent and having that information and asking for the data to ensure that you're part of the conversation and you understand what that looks like, especially like you said, when you're talking about secondary and we're talking about a modified curriculum, what does that look like upon graduation day? And is this aligned with what the student requires to have access to their education?
Absolutely.
So talking about that collaboration component, we know that collaboration between our special educators and our general educators is crucial. Can you kind of tell us some specific instances where you have seen effective collaboration, how it's led to some positive outcomes for our students with unique learning needs?
Yeah, so one thing that I always get asked about is, how are we supposed to collaborate? How are we supposed to communicate? Because, you know, teachers, we might get 30 minutes of planning time a day that we might get to use the restroom during, we might get to make some copies, but how are we supposed to make sure that we're also in constant communication? One thing that I did was I would make Google Forms that I could share with parents, I could share with students, I could share with teachers, especially when it was time for that IEP season's rolling around. I need that parent input, I need that teacher input. It made it so much simpler being able to just send out that link, like, hey, fill this out when you have a moment. And then I wasn't having to make copy after copy. People weren't saying, oh, I lost it, can I get another one? I wasn't losing it in the mountain of paperwork that was my desk. it was contained in the computer. And I really think technology has made that part so much better, because you can also keep a running Google Doc with those teachers as well. So we're able to share information back and forth quickly. I had a student who was in a self-contained classroom that I taught, and we wanted to get him into the general education classroom as his LRE. We wanted to move him from an 03 to an 01 and get him in the general education setting a lot more, because we had the data that showed he could do that. And I wouldn't have been able to do that on my own. With my data, I needed data from the general education teacher who had him coming in for a few hours a day. I needed her data in addition to mine to show, yes, this student is capable of meeting these grade level standards in the general education classroom. We had my data that showed he was blowing his goals out of the water. And then we had her data that showed with accommodations, he was able to make progress. So having that communication and collaboration with her, we were able to change the student's placement to fully inclusive. And because he had been in a self-contained classroom, the school that he was actually supposed to be going to, that he was zoned for, did not have that type of classroom. So he was being bused to our school because we did. And after we had him stay for a year to make sure that it was going to work and that he wasn't going to have to go back to, you know, a more self-contained setting. But he was actually able to go back to his zoned school with his friends from his neighborhood. And it was such a success. And I could not have done that without that general education teacher as well.
That's a fabulous story, and happens hopefully more often than we hear about. And having that Google Doc is really important, as you mentioned, or some form, so that the parents can also be involved. I know I specifically said general education and special education, but then I also think about service providers that are in a building that may not be in that building, you know, 5 days a week during all school hours. So it gives those service providers, meaning occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech language therapist, the opportunity to kind of chime in as well if that student's receiving those services, so that everybody can be on the same page. And it's incredible when we see it work so well, and that you have all the players wanting to do best and really able to kind of put down those notes on a Google Doc or however you're utilizing technology, so that everybody can really see kind of in real time of what's happening. And I've also seen this where similar, you know, a Google Doc or some sort of communication log that then it's shared with providers that are not in the school. So whether it's a therapist or a tutor or whomever that may not be in that school building, that they can then see what's going on. So everybody really is working together to support this student.
Yeah, that collaboration really is key. If we want to see a student be as successful as possible, it does take every member of that IEP team.
Can you give us an instance where a challenge in implementing an accommodation led to kind of a valuable lesson or improvement in either your particular teaching approach or another professional's approach?
So one accommodation that immediately comes to mind is a student I had a few years ago who utilized a wheelchair. We had not previously had a student at that school who was using a wheelchair, and we were scrambling to find where is the accessible desk. The occupational therapist wasn't sure where it ended up. The school itself wasn't sure where it ended up. So we are trying to figure out where is this? Where is he going to be able to sit comfortably and learn? And one solution that was proposed was let him sit at the small group table, and, you know, because the wheelchair would fit under the small group table better than it would fit underneath one of the desks, because the desks were too narrow. But in doing so, the student felt very isolated back there at a big table. And even if other students would come back and sit with him, we were not making the environment accessible for him. We were adapting his needs to the environment rather than adapting the environment to his needs. When it comes to situations like that, there is no such thing as good enough. It needs to just be good. It needs to be right. And we kept pushing to find that desk and get, you know, I don't want to get too far into that part, but we did get a desk for him. But it really just showed if it's best for the student, it's best. And we need to make sure that we're really considering what the student needs to not only, you know, learn. Yeah, he could sit at the table and he could hear what the teacher was saying, but he didn't feel a part of the class. And that's just as important, if not more so, than academic learning.
Absolutely. And we talk about, you know, educational impact beyond the academics. And it is, it's, you know, we're talking about a human, we're talking about an individual. And I think it is a very important role that we have to help advocate for students so that they do feel like they are part of a group and feel part of that classroom community is incredibly important for us as adults. And so I appreciate that you kind of continued that hard work to ensure that that student, and I know that's probably one of 1,000 stories that probably combined we could all share of how to really stay focused and student focused and in our conversations. And I like that, you know, that making it happen and good is good, right? Like, don't make it a little shorter because you can't find that need. And I think now more than ever post pandemic, we have students that have multiple situations and concerns and educational impact and mental health. And as again, professionals being that voice to really, you know, and it's also hard because there's lack of funding and lack of educators and, you know, and really trying to create this balance, but ultimately keeping student focused through all of that. And in terms of even, you know, back to our topic today and selecting a proper, you know, differentiation or accommodation or modification, So we know that technology plays that significant role. We've kind of talked about that a little bit in education. How have you seen technology effectively support, whether it was differentiation or accommodations or modifications for students? Do you have any specific examples?
Yeah, so one of them that we already mentioned were those accessibility features in the Chromebook. Text to speech, there was also dictation where the student could speak and it would type in what they're saying. That's so huge for a student who has previously had to rely on someone else to type for them or to read to them. They're able to use technology in such a way that it's increasing their independence and giving them more autonomy and more responsibility. And that's just as beneficial as academic progress. We need students who are independent. We need students who are able to do things for themselves, and the students enjoy it much better. You know, if you have a kindergarten student who might need to have something read to them, that's one thing. But if you have a 14-year-old who needs something read out loud, they don't necessarily want that extra attention. They don't want people to look at them. They don't want that accommodation. So they reject it, don't use it, and then they suffer for it because they're not able to access the curriculum. But with these technological advances, the student can use that accommodation in a way that is not so, hey, look at me. It's, you know, it's they're using their headphones and they look over and possibly one of their gen ed peers is also doing the same thing because maybe they just want to have it read to them that day. It takes away some of the stigma of using those accommodations, which I think is great, because if a student refuses an accommodation, it's not helping.
So how do you measure the success, or what would your take be for a recommendation for parents or professionals that are listening, or how do you personally measure the success of inclusion or accommodations, differentiations that are beyond academics?
So when I'm measuring data for anything, it has to be something that is observable. And so even if it's not academic, you know, if I'm observing a student's behavior or something like that, it has to be something that I can note, that I can actually see, that I can hear, et cetera. You know, if I would never have a goal that says, you know, little Susie will not daydream during math class, because I can't observe that. I can't go into her brain and know whether she's daydreaming or not. So I might be able to say, you know, little Susie will turn in her assignment on time, because if she's doing her assignment and working and she's not daydreaming and she's not looking around, then she will be able to turn it in on time. And that's something that I can measure. That's something that is observable. Progress monitoring data can be for any goal. And it's not just an academic progress monitoring. Like, we're going to look at a social goal. Like, does the student interact with peers appropriately? What does that actually look like? We're going to define that behavior and we're going to collect specific data on that behavior. And the data is again going to drive the decision. So if it's an accommodation that we're assessing, or if it's, we think, you know, just some differentiation is all that's required, the data is going to share that.
Can you share a specific example of how, when you were a case manager, you collected data on students and IEP goals to kind of just demonstrate that, you know, it's a little easier than sometimes we think, or we sometimes feel overwhelmed by it, but once we have a good system in place, it comes pretty seamlessly.
Yeah. So when I taught elementary resources, that was my very favorite. I loved my little ones. They came to me for small group and it was just the best. I had progress monitoring binders for each of them. And in that binder was their goal written out, spaces for me to write down the date, put down the percentage of accuracy for that goal. And I had worksheets that aligned with the goal. I had activities that aligned with the goal already in the notebook. So when it was ready for progress monitoring, get the notebook out, take out what they needed, and they were able to use it. One thing also that I made sure I had in there was a graph, and the students would graph their progress. So if they did 7 out of 10, the first week. They would color in, you know, 7 of those boxes, and then 8 out of 10 the next week, they would color that in and see, oh, my progress is going up. So they loved that because they liked seeing it. We would talk about, okay, why do you think your score went up this week compared to last week? What did you do differently? Or if it went down, like, okay, what's going on? Where's the question? Like, what questions do you have about this? And it took a little bit of time at the beginning of the year to get everything set up, but it made the rest of the year run so much more smoothly because I had taken the time, maybe late in the summer before school started back, go through my IEP files. Okay, little Timmy has a goal that he's going to be able to read multisyllabic words at 95% accuracy. All right, then I need to start preparing some assessments that are related to multisyllabic words. And I get those ready, get them printed off, put them in the binder. We're ready to rock and roll.
Yes, I, from my in school and classroom days, totally remember. And as you were saying, just that, I was like, yeah, it takes a little bit of front loading as a case manager to get yourself organized. But in the long run, it's so well worth it. So well worth it, right? So that you Absolutely. Are able to collect that data. So
every Friday was data collection day, and we'd get those binders. We would color in their graphs, and they knew, okay, Friday, I'm going to get my binder out of the cabinet, and we're going to sit down and we're going to work on this. It was part of their routine just as much as it was mine.
Well, they get excited because they can see that they're growing.
Oh, and yeah.
Their confidence, right? So when you go.
Oh, and the parents loved it. My administration loved it because all of the data was right there. I could easily show the parents, okay, this is where we were in September. Here's where we are now in January. Flip through the pages. They can see that their student has been tracking their own progress. The student could actually go through the binder and show what they've been working on because they were familiar with it. So we had a little bit of like student-led conferences where they could flip through that binder. And it put a little bit of responsibility back onto the student, which, you know, I'm always, you know, we gotta teach that responsibility. But it worked really well for me.
Yeah, what a great tip. Let's talk about advocacy for parents for a second. So as a case manager, you've sat at that IEP table. And for me, I've done the same as a professional, and I've also done the same as a parent. Sitting at the IEP table, can you think of something that you wish parents would know that maybe they didn't know? Maybe not all of them, right? But is there like a tip that you're like, hey, parents, I wish you would know, fill in the blank.
When you say that, this might not be exactly what the answer is that you're looking for, but I wish parents knew that they could ask questions.
Yes.
So often
yes.
I would have parents come into an IEP meeting and just think what I said or what the other teacher said was the be all end all. That's what was going to happen. And that is not the case. I need that parental input. And if they don't understand something, don't just let me add whatever to your child's IEP if you don't understand it. Ask questions. I loved getting questions. I loved when a parent wanted to be an active member of that IEP team. I loved when they sought out that information. How else can I help at home? You know, what about if we try this for the IEP? The parent, I often think, doesn't quite understand the role that they have, and also that role and those rights are protected by federal law. So when you're going into that IEP meeting, know that you've got basically the US government on your side. Ask the questions, get what you need to know answered.
Yes. And that reminds me, just yesterday, I was coaching a parent through an IEP. And so she said, well, Wendy, my IEP is scheduled for 1 hour. And this was a complex situation. Am I just done in an hour? Do they just like, it was done through Google Meets. Do they just drop the call and that's it? And I was like, no, you have the right to extend that time. You have the right to ask to pause and reschedule. You have the right to make sure that everything's discussed, that everybody's on the same page. So I think it's important to that. Ask the questions and don't feel like you're just showing up and you get what you get and you don't get upset. And so I always liken it to when you go in as a parent to an IEP meeting, whether it's virtual or in person, I always feel like it's like a big party and you walk in and everything gets quiet. So you feel uncomfortable. And then parents, you know, and you're really coming as a parent from a place of fear and love. And so being able to ask those questions, and that's why it's so important to have that IEP draft ahead of time so that you can really look through the information, that you can understand it, write your questions, put it on a sticky note, ask your questions ahead of time so that you feel like, all right, these are the best decisions for my students' needs.
And ask for that draft. If it's not offered, ask for it. Ask for a copy of the family rights. You know, that should be at every IEP meeting. You're supposed to get a copy annually. Ask for a copy. Read through it. Actually read through it. It's long, but take the time, read through it, highlight your questions that you have, and go into that meeting ready to be armed with knowledge.
How has school successfully involved parents in the decision-making process when it comes to specifically accommodations and modifications?
We can't really do anything without the consent of the parent. Like, you have to sign consent for services before the student can receive the IEP that outlines those accommodations or modifications. So if the parent is 100% against something, we won't use it. We can't use it legally. We cannot do that without consent from the parent. The parent has a lot of say when it comes to the student's IEP, as they should. That's their child. You know, I've also sat on the parent side of an IEP meeting for my own kiddo, and I do have the background knowledge of being a special education teacher. But even so, I was intimidated coming in as a parent because I'm like, I didn't feel like I had as much say, when in reality, I probably have more.
And you're 100% right, because I kind of, the passion behind me doing more IEP coaching for families is, and helping them access special education services, really does stem from my experience. Because like you had just mentioned, I had the background and training. I knew the paperwork. I knew the flow of the IEP. I knew a prior written notice. I knew my rights. But when you come in again with that fear and love, you feel very different. And so my hope for this podcast and this episode in particular, that we are empowering our listeners so that they can then have the knowledge to act and advocate in a positive way for their kiddo. So as I kind of wrap up today, is there a question that I didn't ask or I didn't know enough to ask that we should talk about?
So something that we didn't really touch on is, like, at that beginning of the year moment where, you know, if you're the parent, your student has a new case manager. If you're the case manager, you have a whole bunch of new students. I liked to do a, like, parental involvement pack or like an about me section for me so that families can learn a little more about me. I would include the school calendar in there, the best ways for them to get in touch with me, but then also a student survey that families could fill out and send back. And that kind of helped me get the parent's perspective of, yes, I have this IEP from last year that a teacher wrote, but what does the parent think is the student's greatest strength? What does the parent think is the student's area where they need the most support? And fill it out with your student. I want to know what they think as well, because a lot of times you ask a student, oh, what's your least favorite subject? The answer is going to be the one they struggle with the most. And that's really telling. So if you are a teacher listening to this, try starting your year out with getting some background information from a family. And if you're a family member listening to this, go ahead and make, like, all about my kid, all about us information, like something that we might need to know going into the school year. Like, over the summer, we had this happen. That's some information that you might need to know that really can help set up the year from the get-go on the right foot. And it starts that communication off positively. If you're a teacher and the first communication you have with a student's family is to complain about that student's behavior, I'm just going to tell you right now, you're probably not going to have the best relationship with that family. But if you start off the year positively, seeking out information, giving information about yourself, get that communication flowing, then later on, if there is a concern, you've already laid a positive foundation, then you can approach it from an attitude of concern rather than it being viewed as an attack on character.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. And I did very similar to that. And it's interesting. You would always have a parent automatically just say, what did they do? And you're like, no. I'm just reaching out. I just wanted to tell you something good. And I would try to do it pretty frequently as much as I could with the students on my caseload, because absolutely, it made the IEP meeting go smooth, right? Mm-hmm. Because we already had this connection. They were already felt included, and they felt like they, meaning the parents, felt like they knew what was happening at school, and we already had this established rapport. So it really helps for sure.
Definitely.
My final question is, if you had a billboard with one tip for parents, what would it be and why?
Ooh, one tip for parents. I think really this tip can be for parents, for teachers, for really anyone. And it doesn't exactly, like, this is could be a whole new topic of conversation, but in relation to student behavior in the classroom, that student is communicating a need. What is the need? How can we help the student have it met? And is it that they need an extra accommodation for something? Is it that they need a little bit of extra support? When we view student behavior as a question to be answered rather than a problem to be solved, it helps keep that relationship between the teacher and the student, but then also the teacher and the parent, because everyone's coming together to try to understand what's happening with the student, how much extra support do they need, and it helps everybody kind of be on the same page.
What a great final note. Thank you so much for all of this information. If anybody is looking to reach out to Rebecca, I will have her information in our show notes, and hope this helps people gather and empower for their students.
Thank you again for tuning into another episode of the Special Ed Strategist podcast. I hope you found today's podcast insightful and valuable. Before we sign off, remember to show your support by liking, sharing, and subscribing to our podcast. Your engagement helps us continue our mission of empowering families and bridging learning gaps in special education. Don't forget to spread the word about the Special Ed Strategist podcast with your friends, family, and colleagues who may benefit from our content. Together, we can make a difference in the lives of children with special needs. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and I can't wait to bring you more inspiring content in the future. Until next time, stay informed, stay inspired, and keep making a positive impact. Goodbye for now.